This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Good evening and welcome to this presentation tonight. It's a pleasure to have you. It's a pleasure to welcome Martin Haglund here. A pleasure as well in the context of the reception of Derrida in Philadelphia and around Philadelphia. As some of you may know, for a while in the last decade of his life, Derrida would regularly come to Philadelphia, actually to Villanova, and participate in discussions or conferences on his work, invited by John Caputo. And in a certain context with which Martin Haglund has decided to dialogue and interact. Let me just be brief, and I'll present him, and then we'll have a discussion open to the public. Martin Haglund is currently in the Department of Comparative Literature at Cornell. He's the author of one book, Chronophobia, Essays on Time and Finitude, published in 2002 in Swedish. He also translated Derrida's Spectres of Marx into Swedish. He's published a number of very interesting and important essays in diacritics and new literary history. And what he will present today is from his forthcoming book, soon to be published in Werner Hammacher's excellent Meridian series at Stanford University Press, Radical Atheism, Derrida, and the Time of Life. With this, let us just welcome Martin Haglund.
So, thank you very much, Jean-Michel and Aaron, for inviting me. I'm very excited about being here. As Jean-Michel mentioned, my presentation today is based on my forthcoming book, on Derrida. And what I have chosen to do is I'm trying to highlight one essential aspect of the argument that I pursue throughout the book. And but in the question session, I would be more than happy to elaborate on how this relates sort of to the overall architecture of the book. So, in book four of his Confessions, Augustine recounts a fatal episode from his time as a teacher of rhetoric in Tagaste. The young Augustine has found a friend to whom he's deeply attached, but after less than a year, his friend dies. Augustine is overcome with grief. In loving his friend, he has bound his desire to a mortal being. Consequently, Augustine is shattered by the loss of this mortal being and cannot find any remedy for his mourning. Rather, the work of mourning reveals a double bind at the heart of his desire. The source of what Augustine desires, the mortal life he wants to guard and keep, is also the source of what he fears. In loving the mortal, Augustine wants to protect it from death and prolong its life as much as possible. But his desire to keep the mortal intensifies the fear of losing it. As Augustine explains, the more I loved my friend, the more I hated and feared death, which, like a cruel enemy, had taken him away from me, unquote. The crucial problem here is that the enemy, the threat of death, does not come from the outside as an evil accident, but is interior to life. As Augustine realizes, it was always possible that his friend could die. Every mortal bond is bound to be broken, so one friend was fated to mourn the other. Augustine writes, I was unhappy, and so is every soul unhappy which is tied to its love for mortal things. When it loses them, it is torn in pieces, and it is then that it comes to realize the unhappiness which was there even before it lost them. Unquote. More than 1,500 years after Augustine, Jacques Derrida finds himself in a similar situation of mourning. In response to the death of his friend Paul de Man, Derrida writes a series of lectures under the heading of Memoirs. Like Augustine, Derrida makes clear that the friendship always was haunted by the knowledge that both would die, and one of them before the other. Indeed, he emphasizes that, quote, "there is no friendship without this knowledge of finitude," unquote. The friend can only be given, quote, "as a mortal to us mortals, and it is the mortal friend whom we love as such," unquote. However, that the beloved friend is mortal does not mean that his death is acceptable. On the contrary, Derrida cannot accept the death of his friend and is, quote, "inconsolable before the finitude of memory," unquote. This is not a paradox, but follows from the double bind that is inherent in the desire for mortal life. It is because Derrida wants to hold on to a mortal life that he is devastated by the extinction of this mortal life and cannot come to terms with death. This double bind is irresolvable, since the death that he defends against is internal to the life that is defended. We can locate this double bind on the most elementary level by tying it to life as a matter of survival. The notion of survival that I will develop is quite incompatible with immortality, since it defines life as essentially mortal and as inherently divided by time. To survive is never to be absolutely present, but to remain after a past that is no longer, and to keep the memory of this past for a future that is not yet. Every moment of life is a matter of such survival, since it depends on what Derrida calls the structure of the trace. The structure of the trace follows from the constitution of time, which makes it impossible for anything to be present in itself. Every now passes away as soon as it comes to be, and must therefore be inscribed as a trace in order to be at all. The trace enables the past to be retained, since it is characterized by the ability to remain in spite of temporal succession. The trace is thus the minimal condition for life to resist death in the movement of survival. However, the trace can only live on by being left for a future that may erase it. The tracing of time is the minimal protection of life, but it also attacks life from the first inception, since it breaches the integrity of any moment and makes everything susceptible to annihilation. Life can thus only be given through the movement of survival, as Derrida persistently emphasizes. It takes the time to live by postponing death. What Derrida calls the unconditional yes to such finitude does not oblige one to accept whatever happens. It does not invite one to accept whatever happens. It only marks the exposure to what happens as an unconditional condition of life. Whatever we do, we have always already said yes to the coming of the future, since without it nothing could happen. But for the same reason, every affirmation is essentially compromised and haunted by negation, since the coming of the future also entails all the threats to which one may want to say no. The affirmation of survival is therefore necessarily haunted by mourning, both in relation to what has been lost in the past and what will be lost in the future. As Derrida writes in Politics of Friendship, survival is, quote, "the other name of a mourning whose possibility is never to be awaited, for one does not survive without mourning," unquote. Derrida goes on to specify that this tautology of survival is an invincible tautology for every living being, and that even God would be helpless, unquote. There is thus no exception to the law of survival, since it which is inscribed in the movement of life as such. To live is necessarily to affirm the time of survival, since it gives the possibility to live on in the first place. But to live is also to fear the time of survival, since it entails that one may always become dead or be left to mourn the death of the beloved. The double bind of mourning is operative even if I limit myself to being my own friend. Even the most immediate auto-affection is only given through the coming of time, which means that I am necessarily divided into being a mortal other for myself. At every moment, I have to hold on to myself as a memory for the future, which may be lost and lead to mourning. Consequently, Derrida maintains that mourning in the sense of a general possibility regulates, quote, all our relations with the other, that is, as a mortal, for a mortal, with the one always capable of dying before the other, unquote. The mortal other can here designate both my relation to myself as an other, as I experience my survival at the expense of a past self, and my relation to another other who can die. In either case, the self and the other can only be given to themselves through the structural possibility of mourning. The actual experience of mourning is preceded by what Derrida calls the possible mourning that is at work from the first moment of experience, since every experience is temporal and will be lost. The same link between the problem of mourning and the problem of time occupies Augustine in his Confessions. Augustine forcefully demonstrates that the temporal never can repose in itself, but is marked by the movement of disappearance from the beginning. The past is no longer, the future is not yet, and the present itself can come into being only by becoming past. As Augustine observes in Book 11, quote, if the present were always present and did not go by into the past, it would not be time at all, but eternity. Unquote. Every presence is thus divided in its very event. It, quote, flies suddenly out of the future into the past. Unquote. Whether we examine an hour, a minute, or a second, we discover this flight of time that makes it impossible for anything to be present in itself. Even the most immediate presence is divided from within and passes away as soon as it comes to be. Nothing can prevent this loss of time that is inherent to life, since, as Augustine writes, the cause of its being is that it shall cease to be. Unquote. The actual mourning that befalls Augustine upon the death of his friend is thus an intensification of the possible mourning that is at work from the first inception of desire. Because the temporal can never be in itself, every slightest movement of desire is shadowed by the risk of loss. In Augustine's words, wherever man's soul turns, it is fixed to sorrows, because all things hurry towards ceasing to be and offer no place to rest, since they do not stay. They pass away, and no one can follow them with his bodily senses, nor can anyone grasp them tight, even while they are present. Unquote. Hence, both Augustine and Derrida demonstrate that it is essentially perilous to desire temporal being, since it makes one dependent on what will disappear. But the responses to the same predicament are radically different. Augustine's conversion to Christianity is explicitly a turn away from the attachment to temporal being. In opposition to the treacherous time of finite relations, Augustine posits the eternal presence of God. In God, nothing can ever pass away, since everything is given in one absolute presence that is unrivaled by succession, one absolute unity that reposes in itself. Thus, Augustine argues that man should love his friends and fellow men only insofar as he loves God through them and does not become attached to their mortal singularity. Quote, if souls please you, love them in God, because by themselves they are subject to change. Unquote. The aim of Augustine's strategy is quite explicitly to preclude mourning. The man who loves God and his friends, quote, loses no one dear to him, for they are all dear to him in one who is not lost. Unquote. Following the same logic, Augustine condemns the mourning of his friend as a madness that stemmed from his mortal love. The reason he became susceptible to mourning was that he poured out his soul, he writes, like water onto sand by loving a man who was bound to die. Unquote. What the Christian Augustine must learn is rather to detach himself from the mortal and turn his desire toward the immortal. In contrast, Derrida maintains that we love the mortal as mortal and that there can be nothing beyond mortality. For Augustine, to love the mortal as mortal is deplorable and misguided. If one is bound to the mortal, the positive can never be released from the negative. Any mortal bond is a double bind, since whatever is desirable cannot be dissociated from the undesirable fact that it will be lost. It is precisely on such a double bind that Derrida insists. In addition to memoirs, it is here instructive to consider the collection of texts that Derrida wrote in response to the death of personal friends, first published in English under the title of The Work of Mourning. Across a great number of singular occasions, these texts persistently return to the double bind of mortal being that is accentuated in the experience of mourning. On the one hand, mortality makes every other a unique living being. If the other were not mortal, there would be nothing to distinguish the other from anything else, since the other would not be irreplaceable. On the other hand, the mortality that constitutes the essence of the other also makes the other altogether destructible. No one can replace the other, no one can experience what he experienced, see what she saw, feel what it felt. Derrida captures this absolute mortality of life in his notion of death as the end of the world. When someone dies, it is not simply the end of someone who lives in the world, it is rather the end of the world as such, since each one is a singular and irretrievable origin of the world. As Derrida emphasizes in the preface to the French edition of The Work of Mourning, such an end of the world, quote, does not leave any place, not the slightest chance, neither for the replacement nor for the survival of the soul and unique world, of the soul and unique that makes every living being a soul and unique living being, unquote. Derrida explicitly maintains this argument against the idea of God. He glosses God as the idea that death cannot put an end to the world, to the true and ultimate world, even if it puts an end to the mortal world of a singular living being. The idea of God is thus the idea that there can be something that is immune from destructibility. For Derrida, on the contrary, it is a matter of thinking that every possible world is absolutely destructible. Derrida's reflections on mourning exemplify what I analyze in my book as the radical atheism of deconstruction. Atheism has traditionally limited itself to denying the existence of God and immortal life without questioning the desire for God and immortal life. Thus, in traditional atheism, mortal being is still conceived as a lack of being that we desire to transcend, even though the transcendent state of being is denied or deemed to be unattainable. In contrast, what I call radical atheism not only denies the existence of God and immortality, but also takes issue with the assumption that God and immortality are desirable in the first place. Rather, I argue that the so-called desire for immortality dissimulates a desire for survival that precedes it and contradicts it from within. The key to radical atheism is thus what I analyze, developing a thought in Derrida, as the unconditional affirmation of survival. To recall, the affirmation of survival is not a matter of a choice that some people make and others do not. It is unconditional because everyone is engaged by it without exception. Whatever one may want, or whatever one may do, one has to affirm the time of survival, since it opens the possibility to live on, and thus to want something or to do something in the first place. This unconditional affirmation of survival allows us to read the purported desire for immortality against itself. The desire to live on after death is not a desire for immortality, since to live on is to remain subjected to temporal finitude. The desire for survival cannot aim at transcending time, since a given time is the only chance for survival. There is thus an internal contradiction in the so-called desire for immortality. If one were not attached to mortal life, there would be no fear of death and no desire to live on. But for the same reason, immortality can neither appease the fear of death nor satisfy the desire to live on. On the contrary, the state of immortality would annihilate every form of survival, since it would annihilate the time of mortal life. Radical atheism, then, proceeds from the argument that everything that can be desired is mortal in its essence. A version of this argument is presented in Derrida's essay Force of Law, following his claim that love is always a love of ruins. The point is not that one loves ruins per se, but that whatever one loves bears its own ruin within itself. Quote, "One cannot love a monument, a work of architecture, an institution as such, except in an experience itself precarious in its fragility. It has not always been there. It will not always be there. It is finite. And for this very reason, one loves it as mortal, through its birth and its death, through one's birth and death, through the ghost or the silhouette of its ruin, one's own ruin, which it already is, therefore, or already prefigures." Unquote. Both the experience of love and the beloved are thus necessarily finite. Such finitude is not something that comes to inhibit desire, but precipitates desire in the first place. It is because the beloved can be lost that one seeks to keep it. And it is because the experience can be forgotten that one seeks to remember it. As Derrida strikingly puts it, one cannot love without the experience of finitude. This is the premise from which radical atheism necessarily follows. If one cannot love anything except the mortal, it follows that one cannot love God, since God does not exhibit the mortality that makes something desirable. The absolute being of God is thus not only unattainable, but undesirable, since it would annul the mortality that is integral to whatever one desires. A remarkable example of radical atheism can be found in Derrida's book, Politics of Friendship. At the end of chapter 8, Derrida discusses Aristotle's account of perfect friendship. The basic problem here is the one we have traced in Augustine's and Derrida's reflections on mourning, namely, that all friends are mortal. The mortality in question does not only entail that friends can die, but also that they can deceive, betray, and violate the intimate relation. The decisive question, then, is why there cannot be a perfect friend that is exempt from mortal corruptibility. God is the model of such a perfect friend, since only an absolutely self-sufficient being can be immune from betraying either itself or the other. But as Derrida stresses in his reading of Aristotle, one cannot want such a perfect friend. A self-sufficient being cannot think about anything other than itself and is consequently incapable of entertaining any relation whatsoever. As Derrida puts it, the absolute being of God, quote, could not care less about friendship because it could not care less about the other, unquote. Derrida's argument opens the possibility for a radically atheist answer to the question why there cannot be a perfect friendship. The classic answer is to posit perfection as the telos of friendship, as the ideal that drives the desire for friendship, even though it remains inaccessible for mortal beings. Traditional atheism remains within this model for desire. While it denies the existence of God, it does not dispute that we desire such an absolute being. However, Aristotle's account of perfect friendship makes it possible to read this teleological conception of desire against itself. As Derrida emphasizes, the inaccessibility of perfect friendship can be interpreted, quote, otherwise, that is to say, in terms of a thought of alterity which makes true or perfect friendship not only inaccessible as a conceivable telos, but inaccessible because it is inconceivable in its very essence and hence in its telos, unquote. What Derrida here calls the thought of alterity answers to what I call radical atheism. According to the logic of radical atheism, perfect friendship is not an inaccessible ideal, but inconceivable as such. A perfect friendship would destroy the possibility of friendship, since there can be no friendship without mortality. We can further develop the notion of radical atheism via the notion of autoimmunity, which is at the center of Derrida's main text on religion, the essay Faith and Knowledge. Derrida here maintains that all religions are founded upon the value of the unscathed, which he glosses as the pure and the untouched, the sacred and the holy, the safe and sound. According to Derrida, quote, every religion holds out a horizon of redemption, of the restoration of the unscathed, of indemnification, unquote. The common denominator for religions is thus that they promote absolute immunity as the supremely desirable. This ideal of absolute immunity is succinctly formulated by Augustine in the 7th book of his Confessions. Augustine here asserts that the immutable is better than the mutable, the inviolable better than the violable, and the incorruptible better than the corruptible. All religious conceptions of the highest good, whether it is called God or something else, hold out such an absolute immunity, since the highest good must be safe from the corruption of evil. Derrida's argument is, on the contrary, that nothing can be unscathed, since everything is autoimmune. As he puts it in Spectres and Marks, quote, life does not go without death, and that death is not beyond, outside of life, unless one inscribes the beyond in the inside, in the essence of the living. Unquote. This co-implication of life and death spells out an autoimmunity at the heart of life as such. Even if all external threats are evaded, life still bears the cause of its own destruction within itself. The vulnerability of life is thus without limit, since the source of attack is also located within what is to be defended. In Rogues, Derrida presents the argument as follows. If an event worthy of this name is to arrive or happen, it must, beyond all mastery, affect a passivity. It must touch an exposed vulnerability, one without absolute immunity, without indemnity. It must touch this vulnerability in its finitude and in a non-horizontal fashion, there where it is not yet or is already no longer possible to face or face up to the unforeseeability of the other. In this regard, autoimmunity is not an absolute ill or evil. It enables an exposure to the other, to what and to who comes, which means that it must remain incalculable. Without autoimmunity, with absolute immunity, nothing would ever happen or arrive. We would no longer wait, await or expect, no longer expect one another, or expect any event. End of quote. This passage reiterates one of the most persistent claims in Derrida's writings, namely that there must be exposition to an unpredictable future, there must be finitude and vulnerability, there must be openness to whatever or whoever comes. The failure to understand the status of this must has given rise to a number of influential misreadings of Derrida that I scrutinize in my book. Their common denominator is that they ascribe a normative dimension to Derrida's argument. Derrida's description of why we must be open to the other is thus conflated with an ethical prescription that we ought to be open to the other. However, Derrida always maintains that one cannot derive any norms, rules, or prescriptions from the constitutive exposition to the other. The other can be anything whatsoever or anyone whosoever, and one cannot know in advance how one should act in relation to him, her, or it. On the contrary, the relation to the other is inseparable from the coming of time, which means that the other may alter its character at every moment. One cannot face up to or even face the other, as Derrida emphasizes in the passage above, since the other is no longer or not yet. What I welcome as a vital chance may turn out to be a lethal threat, since it can never be given in itself. Autoimmunity entails that the same temporal alterity constitutes my self-relation. Whenever I open myself to myself, which is to say, at every moment, I open myself to someone who exceeds my given identity and always may violate me to the point of death. This autoimmune openness to the other is not something one can choose, and it cannot be posited as good in itself, since it opens the possibility of existence at the same time as it opens the peril of destruction. When Derrida writes that there must be autoimmune openness to the other, or even, as he does in other passages, that there should be or ought to be such openness, he is thus not making a normative statement concerning how we should act in relation to the other. Rather, he's indicating the unconditional status of his argument. The autoimmunity of finitude is not merely an empirical condition that we cannot avoid because of the limitations imposed by our historical situation, nor is it merely a transcendental condition that we cannot avoid because of our human constitution. It is an unconditional condition that, even ideally speaking, must not and ought not to be avoided, because if it were avoided, there would only be absolute death. Autoimmunity opens the space and time for all kinds of violence, but without autoimmunity, there would be nothing. As Derrida wrote in the passage I quoted, without autoimmunity, with absolute immunity, nothing would ever happen. Unquote. The same formal argument recurs with a remarkable frequency in Derrida's writings. Derrida first asserts that in order for something to happen, there must be both a chance and a threat. He then asserts that this double bind cannot even in principle be eliminated, since if nothing happened, there would be nothing at all. What I want to stress is that this argument presupposes that being is essentially temporal, so that to be equals to happen, and that it is inherently valuable that something happens, so that the worst equals that nothing happens. In other words, Derrida's argument presupposes that temporal finitude is the condition for everything that is desirable. Metaphysical and religious traditions have readily admitted that nothing can happen in the ideal realm of eternity, but they have been able to dismiss this problem by not ascribing any inherent value to the temporal. On the contrary, the most desirable has explicitly been posited as the immutable and the inviolable, in short, as that to which nothing can happen. When Derrida argues that the most undesirable would be that nothing happened, he's thus presupposing a quite different conception of desire, which needs to be developed in order to consolidate his argument. Derrida himself has not provided a systematic account of his notion of desire, and it has remained unexplored by his commentators, but in my view it is altogether crucial for his thinking. Derrida maintains that mortality is the possibility for both the desirable and the undesirable, since it opens the chance of life and the threat of death in the same stroke. Conversely, the immortality that is generally posited as the most desirable, as the best, is for Derrida the most undesirable, the worst, since immortality would put an end to the time of mortal life. The logic in question is operative throughout Derrida's work. By thinking the exposure to what happens as unconditional, namely as a condition for everything, including everything that can be thought and desired, Derrida transforms the most fundamental assumptions about what is desirable. Regardless of which concept he analyzes, Derrida maintains that it must be open to the other, which is to say that it must be open to what contaminates and may undermine it. Hence, Derrida asserts that life must be open to death, that the good must be open to evil, that peace must be open to violence, and so on. Inversely, an absolute life that is immune to death, an absolute goodness that is immune to evil, or an absolute peace that is immune to violence, is for Derrida the same as an absolute death, an absolute evil, or an absolute violence. As he puts it in Spectres and Marks, absolute life, fully present life, the one that does not know death, would be absolute evil. This is because an absolute immunity would have to close all openness to the other, all openness to the unpredictable coming of time, and thereby close the opening of life itself. This logic of autoimmunity is radically atheist, since it undermines the religious conception of what is desirable. Mutability, corruptibility, and violability do not testify to a lack of being that we desire to overcome. On the contrary, these features are essential to everything that is desired and cannot be removed. Inversely, the absolute immunity that religions hold out as the best, namely the immutable, the incorruptible, and the inviolable, is on Derrida's account the worst, since nothing can happen without the autoimmunity of finitude. If one removes what threatens the object of desire, one removes the object of desire itself. For the same reason, the radical finitude of survival is not something that inhibits responsibility and political struggle. It is rather what gives rise to them. If we were not exposed to the coming of a future that could violate and erase us, there would be nothing to take responsibility for, since nothing could happen to us. It is thus the finitude of survival and the affirmation of such survival that raises the demand of responsibility. If I did not desire the survival of someone or something, there would be nothing that precipitated me to take action. Even if I sacrifice my own life for another, this act is still motivated by the desire for survival, since I would not do anything for the other if I did not desire the survival of him or her or it. However, the unconditional affirmation of survival does not have a moral value in itself. No given ethical stance can be derived from it. The finitude of me and every other is certainly the reason for all compassion and care, but also for all fear and hatred. Without the desire for survival, I would not commit myself to anything, but I would also not be hostile to anything, since I would not be threatened by anything. The affirmation of survival can thus lead me to attack the other just as well as it can lead me to defend the other. The same undecidable force is operative in my self-relation. The unconditional affirmation of survival can lead me to attack myself just as well as it can lead me to defend myself. Even the act of suicide presupposes the affirmation of survival for at least two reasons. First, in order to commit suicide, one has to affirm the time of survival, since it gives the time for any act to be executed. Second, without the affirmation of survival, one would not experience any suffering that could motivate suicide, since one would not care about what happened to oneself. The affirmation of survival is not only the source of all joy in life, but also the source of all suffering in life, and can thus turn against itself. The unconditional affirmation of survival has therefore nothing to do with an a priori ethical stance against suicide. It is an essential possibility of the condition of survival that can become unbearable, and the response to suffering cannot be given in advance. Moreover, the violation of integrity is inscribed in the movement of survival as such. If I survived wholly intact, unscathed by the alteration of time, I would not be surviving. I would be reposing in absolute presence. When I live on, it is always at the expense of what does not live on, of those past selves that are obliterated or eradicated in the movement of survival. For the same reason, whenever I affirm the survival of another, it is at the expense of another other. It will always be necessary to make discriminatory decisions which can never avoid being violent. To maintain the memory and life of certain others is necessarily to violate other others, whether the violence consists in ignoring, subordinating, or destroying those others. The affirmation of survival that precipitates responsibility is thus inherently violent. Indeed, the value of survival is essentially violent and autoimmune, since one can protect the value of survival only by compromising it. To defend the survival of something is necessarily to attack the survival of something else. The necessity of discrimination, of struggling for the survival of some at the expense of others, is what Derrida calls, quote, the law of finitude, law of decision and responsibility for finite existences, the only living mortals for whom a decision, a choice, a responsibility has meaning, and a meaning that would have to pass through the ordeal of the undecidable, unquote. This law of finitude is not something one can accept or refuse, since it precedes every decision and exceeds all mastery. There can be no taking of responsibility and no making of decisions without the temporal finitude of survival, which always entails a violent discrimination. This does not mean, however, that Derrida tries to justify discrimination. Discriminatory decisions are necessary, but they cannot be grounded or justified as such. If a final justification were possible, there would be an origin or end to justice, which is precisely what Derrida is contesting. Furthermore, deconstructive reason demonstrates that a final justification is neither thinkable nor desirable. If a decision was justified as such, it would abolish the undecidable time of justice, since the decision could not be criticized or questioned. There would be nothing to come in relation to the decision, which would be unquestionably just, and by the same token, there would be no justice. The struggle for justice has therefore never been driven by a desire for absolute fullness, but presupposes the unconditional affirmation of survival. Without the affirmation of survival, one would never care for a better future and be compelled to make decisions about what is more or less violent. The urgency of such decisions is not mitigated by the fact that the fate of violence cannot finally be decided. On the contrary, the undecidable coming of time is what makes the question of violence urgent, since it is what exposes us to violence in the first place. This argument confirms the need for emancipatory narratives at the same time as it transforms the understanding of the desire that informs these narratives. The struggle for a better future does not aspire to a telos of absolute liberation, but must always negotiate an irreducible discrimination. Whatever future one desires is both inherently violent, since it can only come at the expense of other futures, and is itself exposed to violence, since it may be negated by the coming of other futures. We can thus return to the experience of mourning with which I began this lecture. If the double bind of temporal finitude is at work in every moment of life, it also becomes painfully poignant upon the death of the beloved. To mourn the beloved is precisely to experience how the source of precious happiness always was to become the source of radical loss. Due to a constitutive finitude, every affirmation is inhabited by negation from the start, and even the most active embrace of life cannot be immune from the reactive mourning of death. Consequently, Derrida's reflections on mourning always proceed from the absolute destructibility of life, from what he calls the incinerating blaze and the terrible light, which reveals that the dead other is no longer and will never be again. It is this radical finitude of the other that calls forth the desire to keep the memory of the other in ourselves. But the same finitude entails that the possibility of keeping the other is the impossibility of keeping the other unscathed. The death of the other reinforces this impossibility in the most agonizing way, since it marks a violent alterity that cannot be overcome. All our memories of the other, all the traces we keep of him or her or it, are powerless to make the other come back to life. In Derrida's striking formulation, it is therefore we cry, quote, "We weep precisely over what happens to us when everything is entrusted to the sole memory that is in me or in us." Unquote. The origin of tears is thus the experience of mortal survival. The effects of such survival can be terrifying and unbearable. But this does not mean that the mortality of survival is a negative predicament that prevents us from having an ideal relation to the other. Rather, the mortality of survival is the condition for every relation to the other. If the other could be fully incorporated in ourselves, there would be no other, and if the other were not mortal, there would be no desire to keep the other. Moreover, the self cannot even be given to itself before this possibility of mourning. The actual mourning of the beloved testifies to a possible mourning that is operative in every relation from the beginning. The experience of such mourning is the experience of radical atheism. Mourning stems from the attachment to a mortal other and from the desire to hold on to this mortal other. It is thus entirely consistent that the Christian Augustine condemns the mourning of his friend with which I began this lecture. While Augustine deplores the desire for mortal life that made his former self so vulnerable, his account of this desire testifies to an experience of radical atheism that remains legible in the Confessions. I want to conclude this lecture by quoting a remarkable example of such radical atheism. The passage in question recounts how the bereaved Augustine refused to seek comfort in God, since God could not replace his mortal friend. Augustine's official narrative would maintain that the God who refused was just a Manichaean phantasm, and not the true Christian God he discovered later in his life. But his writing also tells another story. The reason why Augustine refused to seek comfort in God was not because he had an inadequate understanding of God's immortality, but because his desire for his mortal friend was incompatible with the desire for the immortality of God. If one wants a mortal friend, one cannot want an immortal God for a friend, since immortality would cancel out the possibility of having mortal friends. It follows that there cannot even in principle be a transcendent consolation for the loss of mortal friends, and no final cure for the affliction of mourning. Here is Augustine, living in the terrible light of irrevocable death, and yet maintaining the memory of his friend in an indefinite struggle for survival. Quote, "My heart was darkened over with sorrow, and whatever I looked at was death. My own country was a strange torment to me, my own home was a strange unhappiness. All those things which we had done and said together became, now that he was gone, sheer torture to me. I had become a great riddle to myself, and I used to ask my soul why it was sad and why it disquieted me so sorely. And my soul did not know what to answer. If I said, trust in God, it very rightly did not obey me, because the man whom I had lost, my dearest friend, was more real and better than the fantastic God in whom my soul was asked to trust." Unquote. Thank you. I think there are two questions there, and I would like to answer both, actually. So, I mean, the first question concerns sort of the trajectory of Derrida's work, that is to say, like, in view of the logic he developed early on, how does that relate to his work on ethical and religious categories in the last 15 years of his life and so on. And it's precise. I mean, one of the things that the book tries to do is to give a different reading of that trajectory. That is to say, when Derrida starts talking about faith and messianicity and so on in the later work, I try to show, I didn't do this here, now the specific example, but the logic of desire that I develop under the heading of radical atheism precisely provides a framework for a different type of reading of these categories. That is to say, for traditional atheism, it would be a matter of like denouncing messianic hope as an illusion, for example, whereas for radical atheism, it would be a matter of rethinking it would be not just denouncing it, but saying that, like, actually, not denouncing hopes for health, for struggles for justice, struggles for salvation, and so on, but read them precisely as motivated by this desire for survival that I was talking about. So so if messianic hope would traditionally be seen as a hope for the immutable, the immortal, absolute redemption, and so on, so that actually that hope itself was preceded and contradicted from within by a desire for survival. And that's exactly how I read Derrida's notion of the messianic. So that messianic hope for Derrida is always a hope for temporal survival. Faith is always faith in the finite. And even when he... even does that with the name of God in his engagement with Augustine in sort of confession, that is to say, the starting point for Derrida there is like Augustine's phrase, what do I love when I love my God? And the way Augustine answers that in the Confessions is that's precisely, say, when I love my God, I turn myself towards the immortal and not towards the mortal. I mean, this is the crucial sort of distinction that organizes the Confessions. And instead, Derrida tries to re-inscribe that even the purported desire for God is itself a desire for the mortal. So the fact that God always becomes embodied or instantiated in a specific thing is not other negative theology, something that should be avoided, but that's precisely an effect of that, like, all desires desire for something that can be lost. So in light of that, I try to show how all these categories, in sort of very elaborate readings, show how these categories do not line up with the types of readings that have been proposed by Capodo and others, or Levinasian reading of these categories. And that ties into the second question, which the infinity in Levinas is always ultimately a positive infinity, that is to say, the infinity of the good beyond being and so on. And so in that way, even though the distinction between Greek and Jewish metaphysics here is sort of derivative in relation to the level that Derrida argues on. That is to say, as I show in my chapter on Levinas, that like his argument always comes back, his notion of infinity, his notion of positive infinity, that is something that is absolutely in itself, ultimately. Whereas Derrida's notion of infinity is the notion of the negative infinity of time, that is to say, something that can never be in itself. So I don't think that the religious notion of infinity that comes back in Levinas is ultimately a version of this ideal of immunity. That is to say, so even if you could have all these differentiations between Greek and Jewish metaphysics, like the point for Derrida and the point I'm trying to pursue in the book is that they both end up having to ultimately have an instance that is absolutely immune. That is to say, that's the only way also you can posit the other as good in itself. That is to say, if the other is completely immune from becoming evil, from becoming bad, and so on. So all these terms, trace, infinity, messianic, I try to unpack very clearly what Derrida does with these things and how they're very different from what Levinas does with them. So I don't think that one could simply say that this idea of absolute immunity, that they criticize that's limited to Greek ontology, but I think but one could show that informs in the last instance something like Levinas is thinking as well. Yeah, I think so.
I was wondering what happens to the model if you introduce Christ
One could argue there's a long tradition of this argument, and Zizek is perhaps the latest articulator of this argument. Mm. But in some ways, God dies in Christ.
Yeah.
A kind of kenosis, dying in Christ, and in a sense, the love of God through Christ.
Yeah.
Is something like a repetition of that mortality. That in fact, the Christ figure as a kind of mediating figure introduces something like temporal desire into the eternal.
Yeah. This is a very interesting question. I think the starting point for all these debates is Hegel's reading of Christ, of course. That is to say, Hegel's idea, and this is for Hegel, of course, why Christianity is a more advanced religion than the other, that it realizes that, like, actually, negation, which for Hegel ultimately is the negation of time, that is in the eternal itself. So that is to say, so the eternal has to go out of itself, negate itself, to come back to itself. You know, and Christ is exemplary for this because by freely choosing to die, that is to say, so he takes the negativity of mortal life, which is the fact that we're always passing away and so on, and resisting death. Then Christ says like, no, I choose to die, and thereby I negate this negation. You know, this would be sort of the idea. The short version of this Hegelian reading is sort of the Jesus Christ superstar, that to conquer death you only have to die. I mean, this is the idea. But what I'm trying to articulate is precisely why one cannot conquer death in this way, why one cannot want to die. Because, I mean, ultimately, if we would press the Hegelian reading, it would be the fact that our sin ultimately is the fact that we cannot embrace death. That is to say, that we struggle to hold on to survive as mortal beings, you know, and thereby we perpetuate negativity. That is to say, if I am mortal, and that is to say constituted by the negation of time, by passing away, but cannot embrace this and consistently seek to persist nevertheless, that is precisely persisting in sin. I mean, persisting in this desire for mortal life. And then what Christ then would do for us would be to, like, do this which we are not able to do, that is to say, accept death, take it upon, thereby he would negate this negativity. So if read that way, it is yet another version of sort of of overcoming this desire for survival that I want to articulate as constitutive. But what's interesting about that reading is that it acknowledges that that desire comes first. That is to say, that this is the problem we start out from. And this is what Augustine does too. First of all, like, he wants to, like, hold on to all these mortal things, and that's the starting point of the problem, and that's what must be overcome. And why I'm interested in that is precisely because that locates the fundamental drama of desire not in the lack or absence of the immortal, but in this internal contradiction of the mortal itself. The moves of radical atheism could be like, in regard to this religious idea of immunity, could be, it's like in two steps, really. I mean, the first is to show that what is supposedly the most desirable, this complete immunity from change, from death, and so on, is not only unattainable, but undesirable, because it would, in canceling out negativity, time, and so on, it would cancel out life itself. And the second step is then to locate the drama of desire not in relation to the absence of this absolute, but in this double bind of mortal life itself. So I think that but the whole so and in the second movie we also have to show the traces of this problematic in the religious texts themselves, you know. So that's why it's like, unlike a traditional atheism, it's not like, oh, let's do away with this whole tradition and it's all illusion, but this logic gives you access to these texts and these problematics to read them in a different light. And that's how I see Derrida's late engagement with the religious tradition. That's precisely, so it provides a framework for reading his intervention, his taking seriously of this tradition without collapsing him back into it. So that's a very roundabout way of answering your question, but sort of yes and no. I mean, like, on the one hand, I think this, at least the Hegelian's reading of Christ, I mean, it does introduce a temporality into the eternal, but only to negate it in the next step, that is to say. And that's, yeah.
It isn't, I mean, at least the Hegelian
yeah.
model of that aside, I mean, is something, like if you think about a kind of imitatio Christi, I mean, there is built right into the yearning for eternity. There is also this yearning for death. I mean, that is the crucial moment, and it has to be repeated.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You know, and it would depend what we mean by death here, because I think there's certainly the whole problem also for Christianity in the sense of Jesus in relation to his disciples. So did he have a favorite and so on? So he would single out someone mortal, you know, and this would be very problematic, right? And already the fact, the incarnation itself is a sort of like, in order to become desirable, God has to become this singular, irreplaceable body, you know, to become this vector for desire in the first place. That's very interesting from my perspective, right? But the point would be that this is not some transitional stage. This is like, it's part of the essence of desire. Like, I mean, part of why I love you is that you can be lost, you know, that you can, and that makes sort of the possibility of the bad, the evil, intrinsic to whatever good I want. Because if you could not be lost, you wouldn't be singular, you wouldn't be desirable as such for me. So I think there are all sorts of resources in the in the whole grappling with the story of Christ in the tradition to start thinking about these issues in this light. And that's one of the things that the logic of radical atheism wants to enable, like a reincarnation. So,
And it was about the theme of survival, which it seems to be like half your book is about atheism. Sorry.
And
then the other subtitle is about life.
Yeah.
And so I'm sometimes wondering how they're connected, but maybe just on life first. Is that when you see the buildup of large of critique and also explanation of life with temporality? But I'm wondering if you need more than just that to discuss this topic. Just on a basic, if you want to go back to history class, you need something like organization. You need something like sense. You need things that are okay, not immune to temporality, but that may not be reducible to time, or maybe have a different temporality than just simply the trace.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering if you add any more to life than just thinking of your temporality. And, I mean, even Derrida has this theme of living well.
Yeah.
Which seems maybe not entirely addressed. And then just as a kind of supplement, do you find it at all useful, like contributions by someone like Deleuze or sort of new biological theory, is that at all useful to you, or do you find that interferes with this debate and it doesn't add?
Right. That's an excellent question. And first of all, the way, the level on which I argue and the level on which I situate Derrida's arguments is like a very minimal, sort of minimal conditions of possibility level of argument, you know? So the point would be that, of course, then on other levels, there are all sorts of other factors that come in. And it's not that I don't think that those things are important, but they would have to be rethought in accordance with these minimal conditions. That would be the point. So if you move, for example, from my level of argument to a more, say, substantial notion of life that would involve all these other questions of organization and so on, that the question would be if then the presuppositions and the way in which you elaborate the logic on that level, if that was took into account the logic that I've elaborated on this level, you know, that would be one thing, and I think that's how I would want to proceed and then rethink all the other. But vis-a-vis many other discourses of life, I think the intervention would often be to show how these unthought aporias emerge in these other levels because this fundamental logic is not thought through. So it's necessary but not sufficient conditions of life that I'm talking about, I think, would be the most concise way of talking about it. So, so that would be so. So, in this very minimal sense of life as life, death as survival, and then like it would be a matter of thinking through what are the implications of this constitutive condition for all these other levels and for the way they have been conceptualized and thought in the history of philosophy and so on. And specifically, then, how that would come to relate to Deleuze, which is actually
a subsequent project I have exactly around the questions of time and desire. I mean, like the one of the questions it would pose to Deleuze is like what seems to me the value of health that runs throughout his work. That is to say, there is like a sense of like becoming healthy, becoming like overcoming the reactive and so on. Like so that, in light of the logic I'm developing, I would put a lot of pressure on those notions in Deleuze and interrogate to what extent they fail to think that like reactivity is inherent to activity, that death is inherent to life, that like contamination is inherent to health, and so on. And that's not settled in advance, but this is sort of the conceptual apparatus with which I would approach any other system of thinking. And the specific outcome of that would depend on the on what I engage with. So.
You say that you want to ground the illusions or the mistake of in this desire for survival.
Yeah.
How is that different from Freud and Freud's view?
Yeah.
Of illusion, which is the desire for survival that allows us and forces to invent these things.
Right.
How is it? Is
the Okay, which specific Freud are you thinking about in that? Like, as a sort of, is that the general?
I'm just thinking of civilizations.
Yeah. Well, there are. It's in the book. I don't engage so much with psychoanalysis because that belongs to what I'm currently working on, which is. So it was too central for me to like just make it a part of the book because it totally informs now my subsequent project, and I'm coming to answering your question. This is just a preamble, articulating a thinking of what I call chrono libido, that is to say, the relation between time and desire, and pursuing this idea of a constitutive drive for survival, and on the basis of that, rethinking the constitution of the libidinal economy through rereadings of Freud and Lacan and so on. And the crucial difference there that I elaborate is precisely the fact that for all its groundbreaking achievements, like the psychoanalytic conception of desire, does not call into question that our experience of temporal being is the experience of a lack of being. You know, this is most sort of consistent in Lacan, but already in Freud. So in that way, psychoanalysis would be a very sophisticated version of what I call traditional atheism. That is to say, it would say that these things are an illusion, there is no fullness, but there is a desire for fullness, and this is the truth of desire. That is to say, to come down to and face the truth of our desire for Lacan is to face this fact that like there is no such thing, there is no fullness, but this is like the deepest level that we should come from. We have this desire, and that's what sort of drives us on. But and in relation to that, I'm trying to show that this idea of a lack of being, which is for Lacan the repressed truth of desire, is itself a repression of this constitutive drive for survival. That is to say, the fundamental problem of desire is not that we can't have this unattainable fullness, but the fact that the very thing we want is also the thing we fear. So that's, and in relation to something like the reading of Augustine that I do here, that would be very concretely exemplified by that. The deepest repressed level in Augustine is not this lack of being, the lack of God, and so on. It's quite articulated. But what he tries to get away from is that this bondage to mortal being, that is to say, temporal finitude is the condition for both what he wants and what he fears. That is, it's that desire for mortal survival I'm trying to articulate. And to rethink all the problems that Freud and Lacan deal with, not on the basis, to think the libidinal economy, not on the basis of a drive for fullness, but on the basis of a drive for survival, and see what difference that makes in the assessment of the drama of desire. And in that, I mean, I have a lot of resources in both Freud and Lacan, and that's an important tradition to me, but the difference would be that I don't think that the drive for fullness is operative in the way that Freud and Lacan think it is. That's perhaps a little bit difficult. Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah.
It seems like the history of atheists, as I know it, before the radical atheists you described, the politics of the atheists can span from like a liberal church-state separation to like the argument against God is that it oppresses the people, or it's the power of the church. And so there are these politics to disenfranchise the church or to hang priests or to just like have a constitution that tries to remove the craziness of politics. What kinds of politics follow from the radical atheists as you described it?
Right.
Big question.
I mean, my last chapter is on this, which it's on what autoimmunity of democracy, and it's about like what a deconstructive thinking of politics would be. There, while I don't think that you can derive either an ethics or the politics as such from this type of logic or from Derrida's thinking in general, I argue that like the logic of radical atheism has two main consequences for the thinking of politics, I say. And the first is that it performs what Derrida calls a hyper-politicization. And a hyper-politicization is the fact that like that you show that nothing is immune from critique, no border is indivisible. So so it's and this logic of hyperpoliticization is something I pursue in that last chapter, which stems from this deconstruction of the idea of immunity. And the second consequence is that it enables a rethinking of the desire that drives emancipatory struggle or the struggle for justice in the first place. And arguing that this is not driven by the desire for absolute fullness and so on, but rather for survival. And one of the effects that has is, of course, that there is, and this is a version of the hyper-politicization, that there is nothing, for example, that by virtue of this would make me in advance more prone to supporting, say, a secular struggle vis-a-vis a radically religious fundamentalist struggle, because like this struggle would this logic would allow you to relate that struggle to not the struggle for what it claims to be, this sort of absolute state, but in relation to conditions of survival, basically. So I think that it allows for thinking of the conditions of politics, but it doesn't offer politics as such.
What about this recurrent theme of democracy to come in the last text? Doesn't that look like a sort of project? Not just a critique.
It's the way how I'm trying to elaborate it, and which I think is the reading I pursue of democracy to come is not as what Derrida calls democracy to come actually describes the condition for any politics. He says that like every trace is a trace of democracy and so on. Like it's not that it's not a utopian horizon, but it's something by drawing on the problems of politics that are most strongly highlighted in the democratic tradition, he rearticulates the conditions of politics. But it doesn't. Democracy to come is not on my reading, and I think this is a utopian horizon or something, but it precisely reinscribes every political struggle as a struggle for a mortal future, for living on in a certain tradition and so on. But it doesn't. These are the two moves I'm trying to show that Derrida pursues under the heading of democracy: A, hyper-politicization, that is to say, nothing is immune from critique; B, the struggle for justice, political struggle, and so on, is not driven by a desire for absolute fullness, but by a desire for survival. And then thinking through the consequences of that logic, it's hard to reconstruct this whole argument on the spot. But what I would emphasize is one of the things I'm trying to show there in that last chapter is precisely that that democracy come does not function as a classic utopia or a telos in Derrida. But does allow for an engagement with the history of political thought, but does not explicitly does not amount to a philosophical project on its own. Because then that's also because the political work always remains to be done in excess of what can be fought, you know, so it can't be it's not
Is that just too, I mean, ends up with formalism, though? I mean, that's kind of what I hear a lot from your arguments.
Yeah.
Sort of, it's a condition of possibility for politics, but it doesn't tell you which politics.
And I think that, and this
is.
Yeah.
At that point, are you forced to supplement it with another political tradition?
Are you forced to
supplement it with another political tradition?
I mean, Derrida explicitly says that, like, it's. Politically, it's nothing on its own. It means essentially has to be supplemented by also. And it accounts for why. Again, and this is in line with it accounts for why it in itself it doesn't lay claim to be a sufficient politics on its own at all. If it articulates conditions of politics, it also articulates why you always have to supplement by all these historical and social factors that you inherit and so on. It would be deeply problematic if it was formalist in this sense of just taking conditions and then saying that this somehow in itself constitutes a politics. It doesn't call for all these other narratives, all these other supplements. And Derrida precisely tries to show why all these other things are essential. And that's why deconstructive thinking on its own could never pretend to take care of politics. You know, on the contrary, I think Derrida tries to explain why. The decisions, struggles always remain to be pursued in all these singular contexts and so on. So it doesn't try to denounce the necessity for narratives or programs or anything. It just accounts for why any program essentially takes place in relation to that which it cannot program, why any program can go astray, be transformed and so on, and why this is both the chance for pursuing change and the risk that programs we want to defend go astray and so on. So absolutely it has to be supplemented as a thinking politics.
So the traditional atheist shows how a desire for religion is untenable, and a radical atheism shows how that desire does not exist, then where do so many years of religious history stem from? Does the desire to something other than mortality come from?
Yeah.
In your understanding?
Yeah, I mean that's what I think I was talking about in relation to an earlier question too. That given that that's the way the argument is structured, it also has to. Be pursued in relation to a rereading of all these traditions and these texts and so on, and show that this assumed desire is contradicted from within, even in these accounts themselves. You know, so it's not that there is not of course there has been the idea that you desire something beyond mortality, but the point is that the illusion is not only that that doesn't exist, but it's also on a fundamental level an illusion that that's what you actually desire. That would be the claim. So it does seek to pursue a genealogy of where this is coming from too, but precisely by locating that genealogy in the thought of survival rather than in the drive for fullness or a drive. And the force of that argument in relation to the tradition would always have to be established in the readings it allows you to do and how it allows you to re-engage with these thoughts that have been very persistent for centuries.
Yeah.